News from NPR is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. I'm Celeste Quinn. We were scheduled this afternoon to talk with journalist Michael Hirsch, a senior editor at Newsweek and the author of At War With Ourselves, Why America is Squandering Its Chance to Build a Better World. We were going to talk with him about American foreign policy, but he's not available this afternoon. Something has come up, so we will dip into the archives today, and we'll go back to an interview we did in August of this year with the editor for The Economist in the United States, John Micklethwaite. He is co-author of The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. A new book from two journalists for The Economist magazine looks at what they call the tug of war between conservative and liberal America. John Micklethwaite and Adrian Woolridge are the authors of The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. Did you know the word conservative was once an insult introduced by the Democrats during the Depression? Republican President Herbert Hoover called himself a true liberal. Today, twice as many Americans describe themselves as conservative as do those who call themselves liberal. And Micklethwaite and Woolridge say George W. Bush, quote, does not have to prevail in 2004 for America to remain in the thrall of the right nation. And in the book's introduction, they continue, we argue in this book that a Democratic presidential victory in 2004 would barely change America's basically conservative stance. For the foreseeable future, the Democrats will be a relatively conservative party by European standards. More on that argument and a look at conservative politics in America this afternoon here on the program. Our guest is co-author of The Right Nation, John Micklethwaite. He is the U.S. editor for The Economist. John Micklethwaite and Adrian Woolridge are the authors of three previous books. Their latest, The Right Nation, is published by The Penguin Press. John Micklethwaite, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
You're at the outset, perhaps, you would take this opportunity to talk about what you set out to do in this book and what you don't want to do, what you didn't want to do.
I think what we set out to do was two things. The first and the biggest thing was to try and tell the story in as close as we could to an objective way about the sort of rise of conservative America and the strength and power of conservative America. What struck us as amazing is that 40% of Americans identify themselves as conservative, and that's now twice as many as identify themselves as liberal. And that is an amazing statistic, not just in terms of the level between the two, but also I think in terms of if you go back to the 1950s, back to the 1960s, when remarkably few people did identify themselves as conservative. And what's happened since then is that something rather remarkable has happened, a revolution of sorts. And although America, as we argue in the book, has got certain conservative traits, which I think you can go all the way back to the foundation of the country with, the birth of this new conservative movement, which is completely unlike anything else around the rest of the world, was, we thought, worth recording. And so part of our book is a portrait. It's a portrait of those people. It's a portrait of conservative America, and it tries as hard as one can do to remain objective about them and to point out their weaknesses and their strengths, but it doesn't try to judge them one way or the other. The second part of the book is an argument, and the argument is that conservatism of what we call the right nation, the conservative bit of America, and plus on top, the relative conservatism of America as a whole, actually explains a lot of America's difficulties and differences with the rest of the world. America, from an international perspective, is simply a more conservative place than others. And I have no doubt at all that there are plenty of liberals listening to your program at the moment. And we're not ignorant at all of the vast number of liberals who live in Los Angeles, New York, Boulder, wherever. But I think fundamentally in the end, if you look at any pretty much any political debate, the mean or the center of that debate in America is further to the right than it is in any other developed country.
Hmm. What can you say about those folks who neither identify themselves as liberal or conservative?
Well, there's obviously quite a lot who fit in that category. And some of them, I mean, it's interesting, if you talk to some Republicans, they talk about people being Republicans without knowing it, or conservatives without knowing it. And there's certainly quite a lot of people who don't particularly warm to the idea of conservative, but take quite a lot of conservative views on things. One particular group is some people like libertarians, for instance, who tend to get rather mixed up, if I can use that word, and they're not mixed up ideologically, but in terms of their feelings about conservative and conservative, the labels conservative and liberal in America. If you tend to dislike government, you tend to ricochet backwards and forwards between the phrase conservative and the phrase liberal in America, because you can end up with quite a lot of Democrats want to increase the size of government, and yet you can find quite a lot of social conservatives who want to increase the power of conservative over your the power of government over your private life, and that I think has an effect. So there is there are quite a lot of people who fit in a category in between, who see themselves as independent, but probably in some way or the other could either be classed in the right nation, or says what we don't actually call in the book, but what you could call the left nation, but which is a smaller group.
Mm. In the book, you remind us that Hillary Clinton was in the 60s a Goldwater girl.
She was. So was Joan Didion and a variety of rather surprising individuals.
Yeah. So what drew them to Goldwater?
I think there are two things about Goldwater. I think Goldwater actually, even, I mean, obviously I'm younger and I was born in Britain, so I didn't meet Goldwater. But I mean, Goldwater was a rather charismatic, very exciting figure. He also, at that time, he did genuinely, I think, represent a choice, not an echo. It's notable, although there shouldn't be ruled one way or the other about him, that he wasn't a particularly social conservative. Near the end of his life, he got very angry with his party over its stance on abortion and things like that. But at the time, back in the 1960s, you had somebody who was directly rebelling against the sort of what seemed to be a pretty widespread liberal consensus at the time. And what was interesting about Goldwater is he certainly went down in flames, so to speak, at the election. And even Kennedy used to sit there praying that he would have a chance to run against Goldwater. But for all his strangeness and for all his peculiar campaigning styles, one of Goldwater's great things was to appear at a campaign site and then go on about all the people whose votes he didn't want, such as sort of lazy welfare scroungers and people like this. And usually by the time he'd actually got round to making his speech, he'd managed to alienate at least half the people there before going. But I think that sort of degree of principled stridency, I think, was very attractive. And it wasn't just attractive to elderly, embittered white conservatives, as some people would think. It was also quite attractive to the young. People saw this person who really stood up for what he believed and was prepared to go all the way on it. I think Hillary was one of them.
Yeah. Now, Goldwater, of course, lost in a landslide, but not too many years later, Richard Nixon wins, winning working class and union votes. And Nixon, as you point out, campaigned as a conservative, but he governed as a liberal.
Very much so. Yeah. I mean, I think that Nixon, if you look back, particularly at the conservative movement at the time, they got increasingly bitter and divided about him, because that's very much what he did. He spoke their language to some extent. He was a fierce sort of anti-communist. He loved going on about the educated elite and how terrible they were, which always tends to go down well in conservative circles. But he didn't, in the end, he was the person who introduced things like wages policy. He increased quite a lot of things to do with affirmative action and stuff like that. There was a whole series of things which he did, which were part of, you could argue, were a continuation of the sort of liberal Great Society programs. There's sort of a kind of rupture near the end where conservatives get stuck between their dislike of Nixon and their dislike of the people who they saw at the time, obviously somewhat wrongly, were persecuting him about Watergate, and so they didn't quite know which way to turn. But you saw, I think, some of the fury which came out against Gerald Ford was, to some extent, problems to do with Nixon. They were also furious with Gerald Ford because he picked Nelson Rockefeller to be his running mate. And you saw that in Reagan's run against Bush, against Ford at the time.
Yeah. Now, Nixon, do you think that Nixon, in a sense, was forced to govern as a liberal given the time?
I think he was, to this extent. I think it's very difficult, if you go back to the 60s and early 70s, the prevailing intellectual And you shouldn't, intellects don't make that much difference to politics in terms of specific ideas, but in terms of prevailing sort of wisdoms, I think they do. I think in the 1960s and certainly the early 1970s, most bright people assumed that the general liberal point of making America to some extent a more European country, of trying to civilize the Yahoos, as one of them said, was generally a good idea. People looked at the Supreme Court at the time, was pushing through a great deal of liberal judgments. You saw the Civil Rights Act, you'd seen the Great Society Program, you'd seen a variety of attempts to try and help government to help people, and also to kind of rein in some of America's instincts, or that was the way it was portrayed. And you saw with Nixon a kind of a rebellion against that in electoral terms, but you didn't see much rebellion about it in terms of in terms of how he governed. You know, people like Pat Moynihan and people like that he was prepared to turn to. It was a much less partisan time, although obviously Watergate at the end began to sour that.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine, John Micklethwaite. He is U.S. editor for The Economist and co-author of the book The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. Listeners, you can join the conversation this afternoon with a telephone call. Questions, comments are invited. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener on line one in Savoy. Good afternoon.
Hi, yes. I just sort of like to remark on the strange fusion of fiscal conservatism and moral conservatism in the present political strata. And it seems like right now with the current administration, you know, he's perfectly willing to mix these things, and you know, we see that, you know, traditionally Republicans are for a smaller government, but you know, we're spending quite a lot of money on, you know, for example, it's something that started with Reagan, not with the current administration, but you know, the war on drugs is certainly something that we're, you know, dumping a lot of money into. So what engendered this this mixing of moral conservatism and what was supposed to be a party of you know, small government and fiscal conservatism? I'll hang up and listen to your reply.
Well, thank you. Basically, I think you can look at the Republican Party, and I'm going to oversimplify it somewhat, but you could claim there's always been a sort of southern wing to it, which tends to be much more moralistic, and there's always been a western wing to it, which has always had a sort of strong libertarian anti-government end. And those two have always been there, and you can go back, you can look at Reagan, who tried to kind of keep the two together. What I think is interesting at the moment is the gap between Bush and Reagan, is that Reagan fundamentally was an easygoing Hollywood divorcee, and although he also signed one of the most liberal abortion acts in the country as governor of California, and although he certainly made moves towards Christian right before he became president, I don't think he was as deeply... didn't see them as such fundamental allies as George W. Bush does, and so I think the tension between the western and the southern parts of the Republican Party is probably increased at the moment. And there are, you see some whispers and annoyances from the anti-government brigade that too much has been given to the social conservatives. On the other hand, the social conservatives tend to complain they haven't got enough anyway. So there's always a tension between those. And there is never going to be a time when there isn't. I mean, you only have to look at, say, an issue like, say, stem cell research, where you can have a group of people who believe that stem cells infringe the right to life against the sort of standard business conservatives who look on stem cells as almost a fantastic commercial opportunity from which the government should stay out of at all possible times. And so there is always going to be a tension between those two things, and there's nothing particularly unnatural about that. All political parties, all political movements have tensions, but it is one which anyone who tries to run the conservative movement has to deal with pretty much the whole time.
Yeah. What would you like to say about the role of religion? Here in the Right Nation, we have people who are true believers and others who see religion as useful.
I think, the first thing is look at it first from an international perspective. What is truly unusual about American politics compared with the politics elsewhere is the level to which politics is about culture more than income or class. If you look at most European countries, the, quote, conservative party or the sort of right of center party tends to be one where you tend to find the sort of richer, well-off people, and it tends to be more to do with income and class than other things. Yet if you go back to the 2000 election, you find Bush, I think he won, if you strip out black votes, who were blacks being incredibly loyal to Democrats, if you look at non-black votes, I think you can say that Bush won more than, just over 52% of people who earn more than $100,000 a year. If, on the other hand, you look at the number of people, number of times people go to church, he wins up to 79% of people who go to church more than once a week. And so it's a much clearer distinguishment between what sort of way people are going to vote is levels of things like whether you're going to go to church or not. It'd be very difficult to come up with a similar analogy in any other country. Politics just don't go that way. So religion, I think, is much more part of political life, despite the separation of church and state in America, than it is elsewhere. That's certainly there. And certainly within the Republican Party, there's a very large fundamentalist and evangelical Christian wing, and they carry a great deal of weight. There's been endlessly reported one reason why Bush supposedly didn't win the 2000 election by more than he did, and I'm going to leave aside all the debates about whether he did or not, is, at least in the view of Karl Rove, Bush's main strategist, is this idea that some 4 million evangelical Christians stayed at home, and that now part of the aim of the Bush presidency has been to get those sort of people out to support them.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. I'm a little interested in your statement that the Republican, the southern branch of the Republican Party, has always been ultra-conservative.
I don't think I actually said that. I said there's always been a tension between, and I said I was going to generalize wildly. I mean, you know, it's rather obvious that the southern branch of the Republican Party, actually, if you go back to before the Civil Rights Act and stuff like that, one interesting fact was at the time there was, it included a lot of relatively liberal people and quite a lot of black people as well.
Well, what I'm thinking is there was practically no Southern Republican Party.
That's what I was trying to say.
And what was there tended to be the descendants of the liberal Lincoln Republicans. They'd been declining since 1930 or so, when they started to go over to the Democrats. The present ultra-right wing Republicans of today are largely Democrats who went over after 1950.
I think there's a little bit of truth in that. There's certainly one big truth is if you go back to the 1950s, what's amazing about American politics is you had a profoundly unideological form of politics because you had one of the most conservative groups in the country, i.e. white Southern conservatives, very firmly in the Democratic Party. But throughout the beginning, I think towards the end of the 1950s, when you saw Strom Thurmond causing problems, and right the way through Goldwater, and certainly when Nixon began to really run, and then right on to Reagan, you saw the gradual separation of these people from the Democratic Party, certainly at the presidential level, and increasingly at the congressional and local level as well. And so I think that's one part of the polarization of American politics, is that to some extent the parties have become much more ideological than they were before. But you're absolutely right. If I gave anyone the impression that that was a long tradition of Southern Republicans in the sense of a sort of moralistic one, then I didn't mean to do that at all. I was talking very much in a sort of post-1970s way.
Hmm. Journalist John Micklethwaite, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's one of the authors of The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. He is U.S. editor for The Economist. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. I invite you to join the discussion. Listeners, join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Talking about tensions within the right nation, I wonder what your thoughts are on the tug of war between conservative and moderate Republicans in the state of Illinois.
Well, that's a subject about which I should know more than I do. But the obvious thing, which I've been looking at least partly, is the question of the Senate race.
Mm-hmm.
There were various questions about who should be the representative, and now you've ended up with Alan Keyes. And you go back to the arguments about George Ryan before that. I think, and I am referring to the governor, because the governor, I think, ran into quite a lot of problems from social conservatives even before he started doing strange things, at least from an American perspective, like fiddling around with the death penalty. I think that there are problems in Illinois, but I don't think of Illinois as being one of those places where the split is particularly savage. I think if you look at, say, states like California, you saw a much more marked sort of battle between the two. And I think in many of the southern states, there is an accusation put up, or not so much an accusation, or a thesis put up fairly regularly by old sort of Rockefeller Republicans that their party has been taken over at the precinct level and at the organizer level by much more moralistic, to use the stereotype, sort of evangelical Christians and people like that, who forced a much more moral agenda on the party. And it's meant that primary races have become a question of who appears the most strident on, say, abortion or gay marriage. And this has left less room for the old sort of northeastern Republicans. And Illinois is sometimes mentioned in that capacity. But against that, I think, you know, when you had Jack Ryan trying to be a senator, he made quite a lot of noises about being a sort of conservative with a conscience and all that type of stuff, and he seemed to be pushing at least partly towards the kind of compassionate conservatism that that George W. Bush talked about in 2000.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting. I think that some members of the Republican Party in Illinois, Jim Thompson, former governor, even the Speaker of the House, Dennis Hastert, have been lukewarm to Key's candidacy. And once again, we have Phyllis Schlafly back in the news here in Illinois, one of the early foot soldiers for the Right Nation.
An incredibly important woman within the history of the American conservative movement. Yeah. And my own magazine, The Economist, has been sharply critical of the decision to select Mr. Key's. Great man that he is, or great interesting man that he is.
Yeah.
But largely because it looks to us too much of tokenism and too much of trying to pull in somebody who condemned, I think it was Hillary Clinton, on the idea that she was a carpetbagger coming in from outside. It seemed a bit strange to draft him into Illinois. Certainly Barack Obama looks an impressive candidate.
Yeah.
But I think, and I can't claim to be an absolute expert on the Illinois Senate race, so I will keep out of it.
Okay, fair enough. It's an interesting race, and I think the struggle within the Illinois GOP is very interesting to watch as well. You know, you mentioned that word carpetbagger. This is, you know, like once upon a time when Herbert Hoover was president, being called a conservative was an insult. Carpetbagger is a longtime American insult, and once upon a time, the Bushes were seen in Texas as carpetbaggers. When and how were they, particularly George W., able to shake that?
I think George W. is the first one to really shake it. I mean, when I say the first one, compared with his father, Prescott Bush, if you look at the three generations of the Bushes, in some ways you get a perfect sort of microcosm, a perfect history of the modern Republican Party. You start off with Prescott Bush, very much an old-style Connecticut senator, great friend of a woman who one of the first people to push the issue of birth control in America. He believed firmly in government, wherever it was. He was an old-style liberal internationalist, and he didn't like the idea of too much partisan fighting, and ticked off people like Joe McCarthy purely on the basis of his manners and nothing else. And then you move to George Bush Sr., who certainly was brave enough to move out to Texas, and I think was probably correct in sensing that was where the winds were going, that Western Republicanism was becoming a much more, and Southwestern Republicanism was becoming a much more important force. And yet I think when people like Ann Richards ridiculed Bush Sr. for not being sort of Texan enough, I think they were on to something a bit. I think people, if you wander around Texas, you certainly, if nothing else, the arrival of George W. Bush, people tend to talk about him much more as an out-and-out Texan, although they I think there's certainly a great deal of affection for Bush Sr. And what's interesting about Bush Jr., George W. Bush, is when he first ran for Congress, he did get very much identified as being a sort of preppy figure from the East Coast, having been born there. And it was only really when he began to run, when he owned the baseball team, and particularly when he ran for governor against Ann Richards, that his full sort of Texan-ness began to come out. And I don't think with Bush, I mean, out of the many attacks and counter accusations against him, I don't think he is a faux Texan. I think he's the real deal. I think he may have been born somewhere else, but he's patently much more imbued with Texas than his father was. And I think he would have, in fact, maybe seemed a very foreign creature to his grandfather.
Yeah, yeah. Geography, a powerful player in American politics.
Geography has been an extremely powerful player over this entire period. You've had a gradual move towards the South and the West, and you've had a gradual rise of a conservative movement, which is based very much in the South and the West.
Yeah, and out of cities into suburbs.
Very much so. I think it's a stereotype sometimes, and you get this particularly out overseas, but you do also get it, I think, in what might be described as the cosmopolitan capitals of America as well, that all these, say, evangelical Christians are really just impoverished Southerners with nothing better to do. Yet the fundamental fact is, if you go to cities like Houston, you go around the South, you go to Atlanta, the gleaming new mega churches are being built in the prosperous suburbs. These are not, you're dealing with a sophisticated, clever people who just happen to believe something very different to what Manhattanites do.
Yeah. Well, maybe this would be a useful thing to talk about at this point, and that is the difference between what you refer to as Hastert land and Pelosi. Pelosi, what did you call it? Pelosi?
You called it Pelosiville.
Pelosiville, yes. And the difference is between those two patches of American soil.
Well, what we did is we went and looked at Nancy Pelosi's district, which is more or less San Francisco, and then Dennis Hastert's district in your own state, on the basis that they would, in a sense, be the prime minister and the leader of the opposition in a normal lower house, Hastert being the speaker. But and what we've, if you look at the two, there is actually quite a nice contrast, is that you see Hastert's constituency certainly includes quite a rural stretch, but it also has a lot of suburbs in it. And the particular thing which came through to us was the gap between vertical America and horizontal America. I mean, San Francisco is very much a city which is built up into the sky. Hastert's constituency as a whole is a much lower, flatter one. I should confess at this point that the Hastert land bit was researched by my co-author rather than myself, so I wouldn't claim to be a massive knowledge about that particular bit. But all the same, I think there were fundamental differences, both in the way they, not just in the way they look, in the horizontal and vertical, but also in attitudes towards things. I think families, a lot of the people in Hastert land were people who moved out in order to raise families and bring them up. By contrast, San Francisco, in part, I suppose, because of having quite a large gay population, but there's far fewer children per head in San Francisco than just about everywhere else. There's a lot of young singles. It's full of cosmopolitan elite, what some people call the new phrase metrosexuals, and there is it's a very different atmosphere, not just in those things, but also in their attitude towards government. If you look at and the tolerance to which they show, I mean, one obvious example is the question of beggars and things like that, where San Francisco, for better or worse, has become a kind of mecca for beggars by offering extremely generous payments to people who come there, and offering a particularly generous way of looking after them. And that's seen as part of the great liberal tradition of San Francisco. And although it's become a slight issue in the election, you could look at the recent election, where it's worth remembering that Gavin Newsom, the mayor who won and who very much introduced the subject of gay marriage or let gay marriages go ahead in San Francisco, is that he won despite being depicted as something of a conservative by San Francisco sides, and definitely on the right wing out of the two candidates being opposed. And San Francisco years and years ago used to be a Republican city back in the 1920s, around then, but now it's, I think, got more Green Party members on the council than it has than it has got Republicans. And it's the contrast between Hastert land and Pelosiville, I think, is almost as extreme as the contrast between the physiques of the two people. Dennis Hastert, if you've seen him, is quite a large, big former wrestler.
Yeah.
Whilst by contrast, Nancy Pelosi is an extremely thin, bird-like figure. And the two, in many ways, epitomize two different bits of America.
Yeah. So from your point of view, from your perspective, What might a city like San Francisco do to revitalize itself politically?
Well, I think you have to broaden it a little bit from the individual things to do with San Francisco, but I think you have to ask the basic question about what can liberal America do to revitalize itself politically. And I think to one extent, it has begun to do that. I think one perverse accomplishment of George W. Bush has been to stir up so much annoyance in the liberal half, and also, I suppose, a great chunk of the moderate half of America, that he has got people who before were more generally happy to let the right nation continue in the direction it was, got them more angry. And you see this in George Soros's work with all the volunteer groups. You see it with people actually going out of their way to do things to quote-unquote get Bush. I mean, the gap between Bush's approval ratings from Republicans and his disapproval ratings from Democrats is even higher than that, in fact, significantly higher than that experienced by Bill Clinton the other way around, which at the time was seen as a sort of extremely polarized debate. I think George Bush has succeeded in polarizing. By polarizing, he has sort of stirred up something in liberal America. What I don't see yet, and what's particularly interesting if you look back over conservative America's history, is I just don't see the same appearance of ideas in the same way as conservative America was throwing it up. I mean, certainly in terms of the Kerry candidacy, I think it's quite hard to claim that there's a sort of big intellectual movement behind it, which in some ways there was behind, say, Goldwater, and there has been to some extent behind George W. Bush, although George W. Bush himself is certainly no intellect. You've had the neoconservatives coming up with new ideas about foreign policy. You've had the various ideas to do with compassionate conservatism. There's a sort of intellectual agenda out there, for better or worse. And I don't see yet on the left any signs of sort of an ability to rethink liberalism. I think there was under Bill Clinton. I think there was definitely a patch in the early 1990s where you saw people like the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council, and other groups beginning to come up with a sort of set of ideas which in the end sort of transmogrified into that rather vague sounding the third way. But there was an attempt to rethink things at least a little. But I don't see that really behind the Kerry campaign. The main part of the point of the Kerry campaign is to say I'm not Bush. And to try and take it from there, whilst at the same time saying that he won't actually change things that much from what Bush is doing.
Yeah. Well, while Clinton was running for re-election, there was a saying among some folks, ABC, anybody but Clinton. And today, while that was pretty fiercely felt among some people, I think that the people who are anti-Bush are, it's like ABC on steroids. We have yard signs in the community, and I don't know if this is a sign that shows up in other communities in other states, but campaign signs in yards that say simply regime change begins at home. It doesn't say vote Kerry. It says regime change begins at home.
That is one of the achievements of Bush in a weird way, is to drive liberal America to this degree of anger and fury. And the question is whether he's sort of reaped a sort of harvest which he might sow at the election. I mean, our book, as I think you pointed out at the beginning, doesn't say that Bush is going to win the next election. It says, which is an honest answer, is we don't know whether he's going to win it. But it doesn't make that much difference, we think, to our sort of fundamental thesis about America being a more conservative country than other places. Because in the end, it doesn't really matter if quite a lot of demographic forces are on your side. What really matters is that that doesn't make that much difference if you're fighting a fairly lousy war and the economy is not working. And those two things, sort of, I think, help explain why, not in Illinois, but certainly states relatively close to you, but some of the swing states, Bush is having a very, very hard time. And I know he'd love to turn Illinois into a swing state, but the ones, the bits of the Midwest, there is really substantial problems with Bush. But I think there are a lot of people I think might in the end feel much more empathy with Bush over Kerry, but they're fed up with the war and they're angry about the economy, and that makes it very difficult for Bush to be able to pull them in.
An interesting character in political life today is Karl Rove. He's been with George W. Bush, I didn't realize this until I was reading your book, since 1977. And one of the things, as you mentioned earlier this afternoon, one of the things that Rove and others in the administration have to do, and the campaign have to do, is to get the evangelicals out to vote. How is that going, and what are they doing to make that happen?
Well, in a sense, a lot of the election comes down to a sort of gamble, doesn't it? It comes down to whether they can get out, whether the base, which I think most people would anticipate Bush is going to get out, a bigger base than he did last time, whether the extra votes he gets there will be greater or lesser than the base he stirred up on the other side, and secondly, the moderates who he may have pushed away. I think you're going to see next week, and we're coming into the Republican convention, you're going to see quite a substantial attempt by Rove and by Bush to sort of, what you tend to do, the logical thing to do in elections is to first make sure your base is all right, and then go out and try and reel in the moderates. And Bush, at the beginning of the year, seemed to have a plan to do that. And he tried education reform, it'd be an attempt to invade the Democratic era, you had Medicare reform. And neither of those two things seemed to have particularly worked in kind of terms of capturing Democratic areas. But next week at the Republican convention, you're going to see a lot of Arnold Schwarzenegger, you're going to see a lot of Rudy Giuliani, you're going to see a lot of other people who are socially liberal Republicans. I think there's going to be quite a lot about how well Bush has actually tried to get on with the rest of the world rather than necessarily trying to write it down. I think there's going to be an attempt to try and reach in to claw in some of those moderate voters, whilst at the same time making absolutely certain that conservative voters are on side, because big though it is, as we point out, even if you start with 41% of the America saying they're conservative, you've got to somehow get another 7 or 8% from somewhere in order to win an election. And Bush's problem at the moment is that he's doing extremely well with that 41%, but much less well with the rest of it. And that I think is what Rove is trying to engineer. Rove is an extremely shrewd and bright man and a very shrewd technician. But I suppose if he were to lose this election, the doubt would come about whether Bush went too far to try and shore up his base before trying to reach out to moderates.
Mm. You mentioned the war in Iraq and the economy as things that could be held against the president. What about the war on terror? What about security at home?
Well, I think in general the war on terror is a good issue for the president. He's currently, I haven't checked the polls over the weekend, but in general he tends to be about 10 points ahead of Kerry on that. Now, people will point out that's about 10 points below where he was before the Democratic convention. It's an area where Kerry has pushed into his lead a bit. I think most Americans, and here I'm making a wild generalization, most Americans on the whole have rallied to the basic idea that Bush understands that this is a long, hard war and you have to take difficult decisions to win it. And so I think there is an acceptance on the whole that Bush has what might be described as the right strategy overall, the right attitude towards the war on terror. It's an uncompromising, we won't give in approach, and that goes down particularly well in conservative America, but it also resonates pretty far beyond it. The difficulty, and this is where the subtlety of the argument gets more mixed up from the Democratic point of view, is that they have to somehow divide or try and associate the errors in Iraq with some of Bush's overall approach to the war on terror. And that is possible. You can argue that Bush took a far too strident approach on Iraq, and that caused problems with allies, and that's caused problems since then. I think on the whole, though, most of the issues to do with Iraq are ones of execution, regardless of whether Iraq was a good or bad war to fight. A huge amount of problems which have happened there have been due to faulty planning, faulty execution of a strategy such as it was. And so I think there are big issues there, but the Democrats, it's not necessarily easy for Kerry to convert those, even with a great deal of frustration and worry about Iraq. It's quite interesting, if you attack Bush too specifically on Iraq with focus groups, that really doesn't go down terribly well with swing voters. If on the other hand you give the impression that he sort of messed it up, that's or general impression that Bush has not been as good as he should have been, then you get some traction. And Kerry, you saw some of the difficulties Kerry has had over this issue with his famous quotation about first he voted against the war and then he voted for it, or whichever way around it was. The good thing about Bush is, from an electoral point of view, is that he's resolute and he knows where he's going. And the worry about Kerry on these scores is that he's a flip-flopper and all that type of stuff, and you're going to hear a lot about that over the next 10 days, I suspect.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I found your discussion extremely interesting, and you had mentioned something about suburbs a while back, and I was prompted to think. I grew up in a nice suburban town in New Jersey, where 80% of the people were Republican in the time of Thomas E. Dewey, and then in the same town today, 80% are Democrat. And I found that it's really hard to explain why this switch came about, but it seems to me that the Republican Party, as it was in 1948, is so completely different from the Republican Party today. I mean, in those days, the Republicans were Episcopalians. Now they're Swamp River Baptists. I can't imagine Thomas E. Dewey talking about gun control or abortion or religious matters or things of that sort. Now we have fee-fi-fo-fum Republicans. And in those days, Republicans tended to be isolationist and so on and so forth. So there's this tremendous switch in the Republican Party, I guess because they, in order to win, they had to pick up the redneck vote from the South. And so now it's sort of a pandering to rednecks is what maybe some of the old-style Republicans still exist, but they're kind of hard to find.
Certainly, I think pandering to rednecks might be going a little bit far, but if you look at, I'm now urging you to buy my book, which I suppose is the whole aim of this, but one thing we did do at the beginning is we show the changing geography. If you look at the states won by Richard Nixon in 1960, and then you look at the states won by George W. Bush in 2000, there's a very, very clear geographical change. Suddenly, back in 1960, as one of the earlier callers pointed out, you know, the South was a Democratic stronghold. I just checked. In fact, New Jersey, Nixon didn't win, but he won quite a lot of states around there.
Dewey won in 1948, I know.
Yeah, very, very much so. But by the same token, if you look at the Right Nation now, it's a much more geographically compact thing, located very much in the South and in the West, but not California, not right on the California, not Washington, not Oregon. So not on the coast, but the sort of Mountain West and the South and the a few industrial states such as Indiana and Ohio, and that is the sort of core block of it. It's a big change, and that is part of the change in geography. You were describing the Republican Party of Prescott Bush, and now you
right.
have to deal with the Republican Party of George W. Bush to go to
right.
my earlier
right.
change.
Right.
And I think you mentioned right at the beginning the point about suburbs. You're absolutely right. There's no uniform idea that suburbs are generally Republican rather than Democratic. I'd argue that, particularly in the West, suburbs have been a sort of Republicanizing idea. I mean, the idea of a place where people have their own plot of land, where people are probably more inclined to try and form community associations, or I suppose at their most exaggerated things like walled communities and so on, tends to predispose you, at least partially, and here I'm risking it a bit, tends to predispose you slightly towards the Republican policies of small government and stuff like that, because you've got your own bit and you're looking after it, and you don't really want to be cosseted and told what to do by government. You've got your own association which tells you what to do and which you set up for that purpose. So suburbanization hasn't always favored the Republicans. It doesn't in every area. But on the whole, I think particularly in the South and the West, it has tended to be a Republicanizing trend.
I want to thank the listener for his call, and we've got to wrap things up here, and we've got another listener we won't be able to talk to this afternoon. Here to wrap up, though, John, maybe you would talk just very briefly about what the future is for U.S.-European relations, given this fact of the right nation and the unilateralism of the right nation.
Well, I think one interesting thing is to bring up the idea of what happens if Kerry wins, which gives you some idea of the problems inherent in this idea, is that I think there's a general presumption on the European side of the Atlantic that if Kerry wins, everything will be wonderful. But if you look at the issues dividing the Atlantic at the moment, if you look at issues, say, like the Kyoto Protocol, you look at issues like the International Criminal Court, look at the Israel-Palestine support dispute, probably the fiercest of all, on all those issues, Kerry is not going to join the Kyoto Protocol. He might make a few more nicer noises about it. He's not going to join the International Criminal Court. On the issue of Israel-Palestine, he takes a much more strident, at least in terms of speech, an even more strident pro-Israel stance than Bush does. I think on the question of Iraq, I don't think Kerry is offering, he may be offering quite a lot different in terms of the way he talks about it. In terms of active policy, there is not a big difference at all between him and Bush. Effectively, he's pretty much mirroring everything Bush says in terms of the way ahead. So I think there is a difference. Not all these things, but some of them are tied up with the basic, I think, conservatism of America against a different set of values overseas. And I think particularly from abroad, there's a sort of coming realization that America is a little bit different. And our book, I think, to some extent reflects that, is that people, at the end of the Cold War, people thought of America very much as one of us, as being distinctly similar. Now suddenly you look at a wide range of issues. You look at attitudes to government, you look at attitudes to crime and punishment, attitudes to inequality, attitudes to cultural issues such as abortion and things we've already mentioned. On all these issues, America generally take a much more right-wing attitude. I mean, just use the example of crime and punishment. America actually sends people to jail at five times the rate that Britain does, and Britain's already the toughest sentencer in Europe. Or if you look at issues like capital punishment, again, sticking on crime and punishment, Kerry is pretty much the only leading politician anywhere in America who actually disapproves the death penalty. Virtually all the Democrats have moved against the death penalty. Mm. And obviously, there are exceptions to this, but out of the main ones, that's the stance they have. It'd be very difficult to find a right-of-center politician in Europe, let alone a left-of-center one, who thinks the death penalty is a good idea. There's a whole series of examples like this where America just basically has a different set of values. That doesn't mean that the Transatlantic Alliance is dead, but it does mean that so to speak, it's a partnership of two groups of people who don't necessarily hold the same beliefs.
That's where we'll have to leave it. We're out of time. John Micklethwaite, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Thank you very much. I greatly enjoyed it.
John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge are the authors of The Right Nation, Conservative Power in America. They are two journalists for The Economist magazine. Their book is published by the Penguin Press, and the website is rightnationbook.com. And that interview was from August of 04. I believe it was August 23rd of this year. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. We have rescheduled the interview that we had scheduled for today with journalist Michael Hirsch, author of At War With Ourselves. We will talk with him on Monday, October 25th. Let's find out now what happened today on the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Board of Trade today, futures across the grains floor, at least in the corn and the beans, they were lower. The wheat and the oats mixed are a little bit higher for the day. December futures in the wheat pit like this. At the end of the day, 306.5 for the high, the low at 302.5, and the December contract settled at 302.75 in the wheat pit. They were up 0.75 at the end of the day. The March future, 318.5 high, low at 314. Settlement price there at 315. That was up 1. And May futures at 323.25 high, low at 320. Settlement price 320.5. They were up 1 as well. July futures in the wheat pit, 327.5 the high, the low at 324.5. Settlement price at 324.5. That was up 0.5. And the September futures, they finished the day unchanged at 334. Or rather at 331 with a high of 334. Their low was also at 331. That was the settlement price too. Once again, that September wheat contract unchanged. From the December corn pit, 209.5 the high for the day, the low at 205.75, sort of fell apart at the end of the day and finished down near the low at 206, down 1.25. But as you look at the weekly chart, something interesting we'll ask Dan Zwicker this afternoon. That weekly chart right now showing a hookup and potentially should it push high enough tomorrow, an outside up week in the weekly chart just prior to next Tuesday's crop production report. On that note, I spoke with Daryl Good yesterday, and we'll hear that story tomorrow. I'll be off, but Dave Dickey will be in for this program, and he'll run a story that I produced with Daryl about corn on tomorrow, I think, and on beans on Monday. And Daryl believes that it's possible that the cash low for the corn has been put in, but certainly not for the beans. March corn now, 220 the high, the low at 216 and three quarters. Settlement price at 217. They were down one. May futures, 226 and three quarters the high, the low at 223 and a half. A settlement price at 223 and three quarters, off one for the day. And July corn at 233 high, low at 230, settled 230 and one quarter, down one and a quarter. September futures, 239 and a half the high, the low at 236 and a half. A settlement price there on that low at 236 and a half, and the corn pit down one. In December futures, 246 the high, the low at 244. Settlement price at 244 and a quarter. They were up three quarters. Desotes at 144 and three quarters were unchanged. The March at 151 and a quarter were down a quarter. November beans now. The range, 532 on the high, the low at 524. Settled 525 and three quarters, and they were up a half, or rather down one half of the day. The January futures were up a penny and a quarter, with a high of 539 and a half, a low at 532, and a settlement price at 535 and one quarter. For the January soybeans, once again, one and a quarter higher. March contract, 546 and a half the high, the low at 539 and a half, settled 541 and a quarter, up a quarter. And the May beans, 553 the high, the low at 546 and a half, settled 547 and three quarters. They were unchanged for the day. October bean meal, a 155.10 settlement price, up 160. Dece up 170 at 158.40. October oil settled at 21 even, down 37 cents. And the December oil at 21.09, off 34. Now here's Celeste with the numbers from the Merck.
Okay, Todd, overall today, lower day today for livestock prices. October feeders, 113.70 the high, 112.80 the low, 113.12 and a half the settlement, that up 2.5. November, 112.50 the high, 111.55 the low, 111.65 the settlement, that down 17.5. January, 108.90 the high, 107.90 the low, 108.27 and a half the settlement, that up 2.5. October live cattle, 86.22 and a half the high, 85.40 the low, 85.45 the settlement, that down 77.5. December, 89.20 the high, 88.10 the low, 88.20 the settlement, that down 67.5. October lean hog, 73.95 the high, 72.92 and a half the low, 73.12 and a half the settlement, that down 77.5. December, 67.35 the high, 65.95 the low, 66.07 and a half the settlement, that down 72.5. February, 66.15 the high, 64.90 the low, the settlement 65.35, down 20. April lean hog, 63.85 the high, 62.77 and a half the low, 63.50 the settlement, that up 17.5. And February bellies, 97.97 and a half the high, 96.50 the low, 96.62 and a half the settlement, that down 135. The Dow is down 69 points, the NASDAQ off 11, and the S&P 500 down 8.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Champaign Park District, presenting the Tommy Dorsey Orchestra on Monday, October 11th at 7:30 p.m. at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Ticket information is available at 356-9063 or online at thevirginia.org.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's